Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and for those that are disillusioned. Our email address is ogc@accessradio.biz, biz is spelled B-I-Z, and check out our new Facebook page as well at Off Grid Christianity. Today's guest is a well-known author. He's also one of the two collaborators for the book The Shack. He is president of Bridge Builders, helping communities find common ground. He has a weekly podcast called The God Journey for those wanting to think outside the box of organised religion. And if you haven't read The Shack or seen the very successful 2017 movie version, don't worry, as this podcast, I just get a feeling, will be about many other issues. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Wayne Jacobson. Wayne, thank you. It's an absolute honour to have you here today. Thank you for joining us. Where are we speaking to you from, sir?
Hi, Martin. It's an honor to be with you as well. I appreciate you asking. I'm in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area.
Okay, very nice too. And what's the weather like there at the moment?
Today it's in the mid-60s, sunny and pretty. It was rainy yesterday.
Okay, but you're coping.
Well, yeah, we're managing through. It's a tough winter, but...
Yeah. Wait till you live in Northern Ireland, it's rain and more rain.
So I've been there.
It's lovely. It's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. Also, thank you when in our emails for your honesty and that you're prepared to ask or answer any question. You'll be pleased to know I'm not a Rottweiler. So.
Okay.
I'm not. We've got plenty of people over here that would most probably go for questions like that, but not me. So if you're feeling comfortable, I have five questions ready for you. And let's see how we go with it. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring if that's the right way. First of all, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Oh, man. I can think of 200 people I'd want to talk to. But the one I finally settled on, I think, is my friend Dave Coleman, who passed away about 14 months ago.
Okay.
He was co-author of a book I wrote called So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. And I do with this caveat, since we're doing hypotheticals anyway,
yeah.
I would love to talk to him about his last 14 months.
Oh, wow. Why?
Every time I'm with somebody who passes away, I think, man, I wish I knew what they know now.
Yeah.
And so that's who I'd like to talk to.
Okay, that's a great answer. What do you think he'd tell you for his last 14 months?
I don't know. He's been with Jesus face to face, man. I would love to know about those 14 months. I know everything else about how he thought and lived. We were close friends. He was a former Lutheran pastor, defrocked for teaching grace, unbelievably.
Wow.
I hung wallpaper for 25 years, became a friend of mine, and just a counselor, confidant, mentor. I've appreciated him so much. And I know about everything he thinks about everything, except all that he's learned in the last 14 months since he passed away. That's
wow.
What I want to talk
about. Wow. Defrocked for talking about grace.
Yeah. You say he was teaching Martin Luther. Got him. Canned.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, this is going to be some podcast. I'm looking forward to this. Question two. Who is your favorite biblical character or favorite biblical story or favorite parable, please, Wayne?
You know, I never answer these the way they're asked. But I'm going to say that. I'm going to give you God's favorite parable for me.
Okay.
How about that?
Yeah, go for it.
Because God's given it to me about 16 different times through 16 different people. People come up and say, I was reading something today, and you came to mind. I'll go, Luke 14. And they'll go, what? I said, Luke 14. And they'll go, yeah. And I'm going, okay, yeah, I'm not surprised. Parable is the one Jesus tells his disciples. They go into a wedding banquet, and he's watching everybody fight for the head tables.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, don't do this. Take the last place. And if Father wants to move you up, if the master of the banquet wants to move you up, then he will. And man, I was the first time that passage came into my life from somebody else, not just in my normal reading, but somebody said, hey, this was on my heart for you. I was a young, arrogant, with an outsized ego, trying to get to the top of what ministry or notoriety or publishing or whatever. And man, I hated that parable. I just hated being reminded that God's saying, don't try to go for the place you think you deserve. Take the last place. Let me move you as I want to move you. And I've learned that lesson. It took 20 years to learn that lesson. But for the last 27, I've enjoyed letting God be the one to move me and not try to position myself.
Wow. Great answer. Thank you. Question three. You can either be prime minister or you can be president of the United States of America. So that's the first part. What are you going to be?
Since I know nothing about the powers of a prime minister, I'll take the ones from presidents.
Okay. If you're president for the day in the United States and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, Wayne?
Well, I'm afraid for the ones I'd like to pass, I'd have to be a dictator in the U.S. and not president, because president doesn't have this power. But
yes,
I would vacate the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that allowed corporate money into politics, because I think that has polarized and ruined us. I don't think corporate entities should have the same power as individuals, but our Supreme Court decided otherwise. And I would outlaw, the second thing I would love to do is outlaw all lobbyists, which also include politicians moving to be lobbyists once they're done feeding off the public dole.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yes, I like that. I hear sort of hurrah, hurrah all around the world.
You'd wish that our leaders would be so brilliant. Oh, my gosh.
Imagine that. Question four. Outside of family events, Wayne, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date?
Yeah, you put the big exclusion in there. My best days are all family events. But one that didn't include any family there would have to be a day I got to play golf at the TPC Sawgrass Course in Florida, which is one the pros play every day. Yeah, and I was there. Well, outside my station, I was doing a men's retreat, and a friend, a guy who had met the previous year being there, and he'd come to Christ through our conversation, and he knew I was coming back to town. He asked me to stay over an extra day because he and his wife were having marital trouble, and would I stay and help them? And I said, okay, yeah, I will do that for you. So I was going to stay an extra day. And he picks me up from the retreat I was at, and he's driving me back, and he said, you ever wanted to play the TPC course at Sawgrass? And I'm going, are you kidding? That'd be a dream. That's the pros play it every year. It's got the island green.
Yes.
But it's also $400 and some odd, and you got to know a member to get on, and he's not a golfer even. And I just said, it's a dream, but I don't ever expect. He said, how about tomorrow at 8:30? I said, what? And then I'm thinking, where am I going to get the $400?
Yeah.
He's got me on somehow. And I think he saw the look in my face, because there's no way I can go home and explain to Sarah I spent $400 on a round of golf, particularly where we were at financially at that stage of our life. And he said, no, it's already taken care of. I went, what are you saying? He said, I just want you to enjoy the day. So I went down there, played golf, and it was a day like no – it was, first of all, a beautiful spring day in the dead of summer in Jacksonville, which is usually 99% humidity and 90 degrees. It was 70 degrees and 50% humidity. It was a beautiful day. Played golf. Felt like I was – I don't usually do this when I play golf, but I felt like I communed with God the entire time. And I can tell you, it just felt like God was on every hole. There was things he was revealing while I was playing golf. And
yeah.
I get back to the clubhouse and I call him. He's not even playing with me. So he told me to call him from 17T and he'd come out and pick me up. And I asked him to bring me a copy of a book I wrote called He Loves Me, because there was a gal that he called just out of the blue. I've got this friend from California, I'd love to get him on the golf course. And so she said she helped me. She helped put me on. And I said, bring me a copy of the book. I'm going to sign it and give it to her. And so he brought the book and I signed it, and she wasn't there. She was on vacation. So I left it for her. And not only did I have a great day driving back to his house, I just said, man, I said, thank you. Thank you for that. That was the most incredible day I've ever spent. And I said, it's not from me. I said, it's not. He said, no, it's from your father. And he could see the look on my face, because I wouldn't spend $400 for a round of golf. My dad wouldn't even contemplate.
No.
And then he says, not that father. I went, what do you think? So I was driving by here last week. I knew you were coming. And I just felt like God spoke to my heart. First time I've heard him in 20 years. And he said, I want to play a round of golf with Wayne. And I told him, I said, it was just like that. It was just like I played a round of golf with God. I felt that way. And we laughed and talked. And then a week later, I get a phone call from a man who's in tears on the other side of the phone, just crying. He couldn't even talk. He said, I'll call you back. I said, no, I'll wait. Just wait. Took him maybe 15 minutes to collect himself. And then he said, why did you give this book to my wife? And I said, whoa, what are you talking about? I said, my wife works at the TPC Sawgrass course. You left the book for her. And I'm saying, yeah, I did. He said, why? I said, I'm just grateful she let me on. And, you know, I just wanted to say thanks. And he's in tears. He said, I've read this book over the last few hours. He said, I got to tell you a story. He said, we left the church 20 years ago. We had a daughter who got sick, 5-month-old daughter, got sick. She died in the hospital, not because of the sickness, but because the hospital made some mistakes.
Yeah.
And we were told after that's because we didn't have the faith to keep her alive, that God took her. And he said, we decided we want nothing to do with that God. We left the church. We left God. We left everything. I get home. I see this book on my counter, and I know it's another one of those stupid Christian books, and I just wanted to throw it through a wall. But he said, for some reason, I sat down and began to read it, and I'm sitting here. He said, I'm watching my wife. She's reading it now across the room on the couch. He said, this book has both invited us back to the God we always hoped was there. So that was a pretty special day in a number of ways.
Wow. Wow. Well, what you don't know is I play golf as well. And there have been times when you've been on the course and you're playing with somebody. And we've got a certain tee at our golf course where in the past we've just been able to share. It is a phenomenal thing. And yeah. Has God helped me in my golf swing? No.
But no, you don't help me either. They say it's the only sport you can play for 47 years and not actually get better at.
There is that as well.
That's been my experience, yes.
So just to make me feel slightly more envious, I have actually played golf once in California, but where do you normally play?
Where do I normally play?
Yeah.
I play in Ventura County. There's probably 6-7 courses, and I belong to a club that kind of rotates between. They don't have their own course. We just borrow everybody else's.
Yeah.
Cheaper that way.
Yeah, it's a golfing society, we call it over here. It's a good way of doing it. Brilliant. Any famous courses?
Oh, I played the TPC Sawgrass. I've played Pebble Beach. I've played St. Andrews over in Scotland.
Oh, you have played St. Andrews. Oh, great stuff. I've walked it, haven't played it. Well, here's the thing then, Wayne. We'll move on because people go, oh, he's talking about golf. Here we go. When you come over to Ireland next time, I'll get you on some of the best golf courses in the world, which are about 10 miles away from where I live. So there you go.
Oh, wow. I've got some good friends down south of Dublin, so I may get there again someday.
Good.
I've been there a number of times.
Yeah, yeah, great stuff. Great stuff. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment, Wayne?
Well, I've got plenty. But if you're really asking for my most embarrassing moment, seriously,
please.
It was April 11th last year.
Okay.
I returned home from a 12-day business trip, ministry trip to the East Coast, came home and found out my wife had left me. Packed up, took half the stuff out of the house, left me a note saying she was going to file for divorce. We'd never speak again except through lawyers. And I had no idea we had anything going on in our marriage. As far as I thought, everything was great. We just had a week off together before I left on the trip. We've never had a fight, not because I wouldn't, but because she doesn't and couldn't and wouldn't. She's the nicest person in the world. And I couldn't understand what had happened to me at all. And then about 45 minutes after I got home and I'm discovering she left, I've read this 13-page letter, realizing all alone in the world, my two kids come over, my adult children, to make sure I was okay. But it was just added to the embarrassment, you know, that they have that look on their face like dad just got cancer. And it's just it's just pitiful, you know, and sad. And I just asked them, I said, what's going on? And is mom done with me? And they both said, yeah, you'll never talk to her again. And so I felt incredible embarrassment that day, not only because it was everything. If what was happening to me were true, then the last 46 years of my life, which is how long we'd been married, had been a lie. Hmm. And what I'd written and what I'd done in the world and the podcast, all that would have ended if all this had stood the test of time. Fortunately, we found out what was really going on there. Sarah was having some PTSD symptoms, a therapist that she'd gone to talk to about it. And the PTSD for Sarah was not only all the symptoms of that, but the feeling inside that she was a horrible person. So it was something she'd never admit, something she said she didn't tell me because she could never figure out how to explain it to me. Well, the therapist she went to decided it must be because she's living with an abusive husband. And she left me like that in the dead of night without warning. I was gone on a trip, but we'd talked every night on FaceTime and, you know, it was sweet talk. I mean, absolutely had not a clue that this was in her heart. And, it took about 3 or 4 weeks before we could begin to communicate again. And then we found out what had gone on. And Sarah actually discovered at the age of 68 that between the ages of 4 and 8, she'd been molested by her grandpa. And the reason why she felt so horrible about herself was not because she was horrible, but because something horrible had happened to her. And so we have been for the last 8 months in this healing together of Sarah's life. Our marriage got back together. And about 5 weeks after April 11th, we got back together. I've walked with her through this entire healing into a delightful marriage now. But April 11th, a year ago, was the worst day of my life and the most embarrassing by far.
Wow. Well, thank you.
You asked.
I did. I did, Wayne. I did. I wasn't expecting that answer. I knew, you very kindly told me in advance when we were conversing by email, but I wasn't expecting it to be that answer. Thank you very much for your honesty. And I think that can actually link in a bit more, because you mentioned that the therapist was involved in this. Because my understanding, my very limited understanding from my training qualification days, is that if you're going to do these things, you get the other person to work it out. You don't actually tell them what's wrong. You get them to work it out. So how come that therapist got away with it?
I don't know if they got away with it. I've been told by others it's malpractice what she did to come to those conclusions.
Yeah.
Even Sarah had even asked her, shouldn't we talk to Wayne about some of this? And she said, if I wanted to talk to Wayne, I would have by now. And there is a slice of therapists in America that are ultra feminist, where if Sarah showed up murdered someday, who's suspect number one? I am. 90% of the time, or 95% of the time, it's the spouse that murders the person. So I guess there's some therapists that jump to that conclusion, but Sarah's PTSD symptoms, when you hear the story, go way back before we even knew each other. Mm-hmm. I was not the cause of them, except in some sense, as she's gotten a better therapist now and they're digging into much better things, it was actually some things changed in our marriage about 10 years ago, and I knew I was loving Sarah better than I've ever loved her in my life. But that love is a threat to the trauma brain. It's people are getting into your secrets, and boy, you just defend those at all costs. Trauma is a real cause of disconnection between people and themselves, between other people close to them. And sometimes the most threatening person to someone who's traumatized is the person that loves them most, because they're trying to get inside their pain. And Sarah and I, the last couple of years, I could tell something was off. She was actually praying that God would take her every night she went to bed, because she just couldn't stand to keep living with the torment she felt in her soul. But sadly, she couldn't bring me into it and let me know what was going on. I'd catch her out of bed at night and I'd ask, hey, what's going on? And she said, I just wasn't feeling good last night. Well, it turns out she was downstairs crying and just crying out to God, considering suicide, down to she'd already figured out how to do it. And then she woke up one morning with the will to live, the desire to live. And I'm not telling anything that Sarah hasn't already told publicly. Mm-hmm. This is Sarah's story as well as mine. And Sarah's discovered some horrible things about her past she never knew. And I've asked her, I said, do you wish the amnesia, because she had amnesia. It wasn't that they were repressed memories. She buried them. A four-year-old girl being molested by her grandfather is not prepared to hold those memories. So they go bury somewhere. And she's been courageous enough to let him surface, to let God reveal what's going on, to lean into the kind of healing she needs. And now she's discovered she's not a horrible person. Something horrible happened to her. And that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
Heard somebody define trauma the other day, which I love this. Trauma is a normal response to abnormal situations.
Yes.
And I always thought it was the other way around. I always thought trauma was an abnormal response. That's until I've been in it firsthand. Now I know it's all that a four-year-old brain could do to manage the pain she was in. It had no comprehension of what was happening to her.
So. It's amazing what little children can do to survive as well. But as you say, it's buried, you know. And
brain is an amazing tool. I mean, it held this memory until Sarah was ready to deal with it. And though it almost cost her life and almost cost us our marriage, it didn't in the end. And we're just thrilled with what God has done.
So what was the turning point, if you don't mind me asking, Wayne, as to where she thought it was worth fighting for, and maybe the therapist got it wrong?
Yeah, she didn't think the therapist got it wrong. When she left, when she had decided she wanted to live, she couldn't see living with me, the pressure of living with me. Mm-hmm. So the will to live was the need to move out. And it wasn't until we got back together. And part of that was I didn't respond to her the way her therapist told her I would.
Right.
That I would be angry, that I would go hunt her down, I didn't do any of that, because I had some real clear insight from Jesus as to how to manage this destroying thing in my life.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I followed some of the most important elements of that, and it allowed her to turn around and go, maybe I got this wrong. And we got back together actually before she even knew about where the PTSD had come from. She just knew it hadn't come from me. And then she came back from a different therapist. About third time she met with that therapist, and she came back from it and just in tears. And she said, "My grandpa touched me." And I couldn't have been more shocked. She couldn't either. It's taken her months to even get used to that reality that I was molested by my grandpa.
Yeah.
And disowned by him. She knew he had disowned the family when she was around eight. She didn't know why. And now with the memories all back in line, she knows exactly why. And he got caught and was separated from the family. But she was always told he disowned the family when the family actually cut him off.
Well.
Hard. And all the people in that are dead. Her parents are no longer alive. There's no one to really check these stories out with, except there's an amazing book out now called The Body Keeps the Score. And every memory Sarah has is attached to physical things in her life and body where you go, okay, I have no doubt these things are true because of the fears and way the coping mechanisms she's used for life all tie back to the events that happened to her.
Yeah.
And now she's finding great freedom. So we're excited.
Well, listen, give her our love, and that is fantastic. And the fact, obviously, you know, she's still on that road to full recovery.
We are.
You did say that this is public knowledge now. I'm pretty sure I read in one of your emails that this is available on a podcast. So for people that are listening and saying, "I need to know more," I'm resonating with what's being said. What podcast can they listen to where you discuss this further, please?
Yeah, it's the podcast is thegodjourney.com. And the first one you'll want to listen to is the one called The Unforeseen Circumstances. It's in June of last year, I think, June of 22. Look for if you can put Unforeseen Circumstances and Wayne Jacobson or God Journey, any search engine will take you right to it. And then it's that one and the next seven where Sarah and I play out our story together, what happened and what God had done to intervene for us. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, I bet it is. And the fact, well, also, the fact that, you know, you're recording these podcasts within like 3 months of it all kicking off. What made you do that?
I'm gonna tell a story?
Yeah.
We had read a book called Try Softer, and it's a woman who's undergone some trauma, and she's sharing her story in this book, and I was reading it to Sarah. It was been recommended to us. And the last page of that, she's reading the manuscript. She tells the story of reading the manuscript before she'd published it to her mother. Her mother was the cause of her abuse, an alcoholic all her life and a very abusive toward her daughter. Had been sober the last 13 years. And so she's reading the manuscript to her mom. And her mom shows up as a bad guy in most of the book. And she reads it all. And she said, "Mom, I'd like to publish this manuscript. Would that be okay with you?" And her mom said, "If this book would help one person, it would be worth it to me." And that's the last page of that book. And I put it down, I looked over at Sarah, and Sarah's got tears streaming down her face. And she said, "I want to tell my story." I said, "What?" She said, "I want to tell my story." I said, "Why don't we wait a little while and, you know, make sure, let's give it some time. It's only been a couple of months." And I was talking to a consultant that was advising me through this. And she said, "Don't slow her down at all. Telling her story is how she takes possession of her story away from her grandpa." So as wide as she wants to tell it, let her tell it. So we did. And she has no regrets now. Our email, our whole life is full of people who have been traumatized, who have never admitted, never owned it. Most of them have memories of it, just have pushed them down. And so we're spending a lot of time right now helping people who found in Sarah's story some understanding for their own.
Wow. And the search engine again, please, if you could just mention it.
Oh, The God Journey, or if you go to thegodjourney.com and look for The Unforeseen Circumstances, you'll find the first of seven podcasts that will take you down that story.
Wow. Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Because you then put in your email to me, and I've just got to find it because I was trying to be very clever and write things down.
No worries.
It was very good. Yes. You said one way to tell a bad therapist is that they take control of your life for you. Same is true for pastors. Now, you started off, you know, as a pastor yourself. Please explain more, because I'm sure there are people listening also that have been completely burnt from what's happened in church. And you've already alluded to that. So tell me more, please.
Yeah, I noticed one of your taglines for this group is people are disillusioned.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been very helpful to me is realize when somebody tells me they're disillusioned, I'll just look at them and say, isn't that great? And they'll look at me like, what are you talking about? I'm going, if you're disillusioned, that means you had illusions to begin with. And having your illusions dissed is a really good thing. If you had illusions about church, if you had illusions about religious leadership, if you had illusions about God, it's good to have those illusions dissed. Now I can get to know God as he really is, and I can get to know my own life as it really is, and how God sees me. And to me, the process of transformation always begins with disillusionment. And I think some of that disillusioning does come from our leadership, people who... Meanwhile, I think most pastors I know, I mean, they committed themselves to full-time Christian service because they really cared about people and they really wanted to have an impact in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the machinery of the way we've done institutionalized Christianity that ends up rotting that out. And instead of actually doing what they got into ministry to do, they end up being managers of political intrigue in their own denominations or institutions, and they're just trying to keep their head above water and want people to like them. It's antidepressants are the most prescribed drugs on any ministry health situation. Mm-hmm. All the denominations will say that. It's a very tough position we put somebody into. It seems to rot out the soul oftentimes. I was listening to a podcast the other week about David being the patron saint of sexual abusers because of what he did with mm-hmm. Bathsheba. And he's always, you know, here's a man after God's own heart, and yet look what he does. And he rapes this woman and murders her husband. And I think that's the lesson of it. God's saying, I'm going to give you a man after my own heart, and look what kingship does to him. Kingship will always make someone exploit your daughters and take your sons to war. That's what God warned Israel about when they wanted a king in the first place. You don't want one of those. You don't. No man can resist the power of authority over other people's lives and not let it rot out their soul from the inside with excess and wanting to be pleased, and I get my own way and I can justify it because I'm doing this important thing for God. And there's so many ways that we mess up our own souls by doing things that God asks us not to do. And trauma is one of those things that works from the inside and unbeknownst to us, not known. And I think on the outside, someone said last week, which I love this, you can be successful in ministry and not successful in Christ's mission in the world. And just that statement alone ought to make us pause.
Yeah. I remember years ago, and I wish I could remember the statistics, but basically the moral of the story was that just because you think you were to be a pastor doesn't actually mean that God wanted you to be a pastor. You know, he wanted you to most probably be a missionary to somewhere else, Antarctica or whatever. And then you find that people who were missionaries out there, God didn't actually want you to be a missionary. He wanted you to be a pastor, you know, in Central America or whatever. How true is that, do you think?
I think it's often true. You know, it depends. If you're successful in the vocation, you don't feel that way. But if you've struggled, and most have, unless you can get a big enough organization to staff around you so that you can do what you want and let other people do what you don't want. Ministry is a tough gig. It is. And I don't know that a lot, I'd say my calling to it at 16, I'd look back now going, I wouldn't say it the same way. I think a very insecure person needed to do something for God to feel good about himself, to feel special. And I think part of me said, if I've got to sit here every Sunday morning for the rest of my life, I'd rather be the guy in the pulpit talking than the person sitting in the pew. I think that was part of it. Obviously, God had a call on my life, like he does all of our lives, whether mm-hmm. we're plumbers, electricians or teachers. I do think God calls us, but I think the ministry thing has really gotten twisted because it's been more about the institutional needs to hold a crowd, to get the funds, to do what it's become more about that than it has really helping people follow Jesus the way Jesus wanted us to follow him.
Yeah. Thank you. Wow. We've gone heavy already. I thought we'd go heavy a bit later on. So,
we're still in the shallow end of the pool.
Well, here's the thing then, because obviously Wikipedia can be great for doing research, and it might not always be spot on. So, just bear with me on this, Wayne, if that's right. But
can I give you an example of that?
Yeah, please.
Up till 2 months ago, Wikipedia had me passing away on January 31st, 2014.
Really?
For a long time. Yeah, I just watched it. It was hilarious. People were saying, you know you died in 2014? I said, I have no idea. So that's how accurate Wikipedia can be.
Well, you're doing very well. You did actually pass away. You know, you're doing very well. So let's go with this then. Apparently, you were the associate pastor at the Valley Christian Center in Fresno.
I was.
Oh, that's good.
Guilty as charged.
That's yeah. good. That's good. Now, now bear with me with this, because this could be a very tenuous link. Just bear with me, all right?
Sure.
Okay. It was a four-square church, correct?
It was.
Right. Well, I knew nothing about what a four-square church was. So, you know, a quick Google, and up it all came. So I'm going to say to you the name Amy Semple McPherson. So far, so good.
I don't know who she is. I didn't grow up in Foursquare, so I don't have all the Foursquare DNA that you're supposed to have to be a Foursquare pastor. I got invited to come on staff at a Foursquare church that my parents were attending at the time when I graduated. So that was my introduction to Foursquare. But Amy said, yeah, she's the founder of it and yes. founder of the idea of the Foursquare gospel.
Well, I'd never heard of her. But half an hour later, having read about her, I thought, wow, okay. So she started off with the Foursquare Gospel in a sermon in October 1922, right?
Yeah.
But she then disappeared for a month in May 1926. No one knew where she went, right? People thought she'd been kidnapped. They thought she drowned. And all of a sudden, a month later, she turned up in Mexico. And they brought her back, and there have been several court cases consequently. But the thing was, she claimed, you ready for this tenuous link? She claimed that for a month she was in a shack. Which links to a book.
We stole the idea. That's how it happened.
I was just wondering,
tying these together? That's hilarious.
Yeah. Is there any connection between the shack and the book, The Shack?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think Papa was in that shack, unfortunately. It would have been nice for her if he had been.
No, well, I'm not going to give away, because I think everyone should read the book. It just blew me away when I read it, and I thought the film was great as well. But what does a collaborator actually do? Because it's got, obviously, written by W.M. Paul Young, and your name is on the front cover as well. So what does a collaborator actually do, please?
Yeah, well, it was a terminology. We were outside the publishing industry when we did it. Collaborator is not a term that's recognized in the publishing industry, but Paul had this story he'd written for his kids, and it wasn't a very good story. It had some good elements to it, but it wasn't a story yet. It was Matt gets to the shack, and Papa's there, and it's all, oh, gosh, I never understood the Trinity, and there were six pages on the Trinity, and then there were five pages on something else, and when he sent it to me after he'd given it to his kids, because he'd been writing a theological dictionary for his kids. So he sent me that thinking I would love it. And I did love the Missy story, beginning and ending. And this middle part, I just said, you know, what's got to happen in the shack is Mac moves toward healing, that God introduces him to that. And Paul was like, well, I don't know how to do that. And so I said, well, so I coached him. I spent a whole day just telling him how to do it. And you've written the first part. Obviously, you can do this. He just couldn't do it. About 2 months later, and I had people by then breathing down my neck from Hollywood wanting to make a movie of this thing. And he just said, listen, Wayne, I'm done with the book. I think if it goes anywhere, I think you're involved. And I said, I don't want to be involved. I have a feeling that, and I didn't say this to him at the time, but I said, I have a feeling if I do this, he's going to end up resenting me. Because it's a very, there's a lot of personal story behind the book. Mm-hmm. So I said, let me just do that. I'll write one chapter. I'll show you what I mean. Because I took that chapter where Mac shows up at the shack the second time and redid that. And he loved it. He said, oh, you got to do more. And so a friend of mine, my podcast partner at the time, he and I rewrote the book from scratch. Paul wrote the first version in 6 months. Brad and I and Paul wrote the final version over 16 months of four different drafts and rewrites. And
wow.
I mean, collaborator means co-author, but there was a lawsuit involved with all that. They were trying to deny it. But the reality is, yeah, Brad and I were co-writers of the book, but that has gotten to be something that Paul doesn't like anymore. So there's been some tension over that. The fact is, we weren't on the book when we published it. Paul actually came to us feeling like the notoriety of the book was destroying him, and could we put our names on it, because he said, I'm answering questions. People ask me, what were you thinking when you wrote that? And he's going, I wasn't thinking anything. Wayne wrote it. But my name was on the book and I didn't want to say that. So I made up a story. And I'm going, dude, you can't make up stories. And so he wanted to put our names on the book. So we did. And then later that got to be a problem.
Yes. Did you, was it you who came up, and I don't want to give away the punchline at all, but I got absolutely engrossed about the ladybird and the clues according, you know, because it's a little bit of a thriller as well. Whose idea was it about the ladybird?
The ladybug?
Sorry, you call it in America, yeah, ladybug, sorry. We're ladybirds over here.
Are you really?
Yeah.
I kept hearing lazy bird there, but you meant ladybug.
I meant, yeah.
there was a, I think we, I'm not really sure. The collaboration was such a, I mean, those 16 months were probably the most invigorating season of my life. I mean, to have three people working on a story, trying to get it right was incredible. And I'm not always sure, we could go back because I had the manuscript, what it originally was and how much was changing and who did what changes. But I think there was some kind of mark and then we changed it to the Ladybug Killer, or it may have been original to Paul. I don't really recall where that came from.
Well, it's cracking anyway.
And, it is.
Yeah, it's a cracking idea. Well, it's anymore because I want people to read the book and not spoil it.
Oh, and we've had FBI profilers call us going, I can't find anything about this ladybug killer. And we're going, it's fiction. It's not true. We made it up. But it has that ring of reality to it. It really does.
It does, yeah. It was fantastic. Well, bravo to whoever came up with that bit. That was amazing. You did mention a court case. What could you tell us about that, please?
Oh, just it's an ugly part of the story. I mean, I always like to say it was the best of times, as I said,
yeah,
writing it
did.
Was amazing, and it was the worst of times. We got in the lawsuit just out of the blue. He decided he wanted all the money and power and fame from the book himself. And I'm not sure how much of that's Paul, quite honestly, and how much of that was the people around him who. Mm. Gather like sycophants around somebody who's got notoriety and popularity and money and kind of their cash cow. And they're not in any of our agreements with Paul. So to get inside our agreements, they have to blow them up. And so the court case is really designed to bankrupt me and my family, take everything we had. If it had been successful, fortunately, we got out of court and settled it because I didn't have the will to drag this book about love through a court system. And I told Paul early on when he first got inklings of this, I said, tell me what you want. I'll give you everything I have in this book. And I don't want to go down this road. We promised each other we wouldn't do it because I'd been part of that in ministry before, good brothers doing something together and then blow it up over something. And I said, I don't want to ever be part of brothers who are part of something wonderful with God, end up losing their relationship to it. And I worked very hard for that not to happen, but the powers that be behind it, we settled out of court. So yeah, I'm still a co-author of The Shack and I still derive royalties from The Shack and Paul pretends we weren't involved. So that's the way it goes.
Listen, thank you, Shane, because I'd like to lead on, if that's right, from a podcast that's going out in a couple of weeks' time that I recorded on Friday. And that went off on an amazing track. And it was all about the word forgiveness. Mm. And I was speaking to a really good friend of mine, one of my former bosses many years ago, on Saturday night, he just phoned up out of the blue. And he too wrote a book to show up what was going wrong with a particular organisation. And eventually he knew how much money they owed him. And it was a heck of a lot. And he thought, do you know what? I'm just going to waive it now. And I'll forgive them. Just to draw the line, I'll waive it and move on. Even though he was the innocent party. And that's what flagged up in me. I thought, forgiveness, he was able to forgive. So what does forgiveness mean to you?
Well, forgiveness is a big theme in The Shack, right?
Yeah.
He's got his own, the nemesis in his life, the lead character in The Shack. And I have a very tenuous relationship with forgiveness, I think. Forgiveness, for the most part, institutionally, is organized denial. It's really, let's just pretend nothing bad happened here and we'll just move on. And I don't think that's what forgiveness is at all. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness doesn't change the consequences of someone's actions. My forgiveness means I can take my foot off their throat, language we used in The Shack, actually, that I'm not looking for recompense. I'm going to give this to God and let God do what God wants to do with it. But forgiveness, like in Sarah's case or in traumatic instances, and everybody said to Sarah, right, you know, you got to forgive your grandpa. Well, you know what? Let's figure out what grandpa did first. And let's figure out how God heals Sarah. And then Sarah can find a place of forgiveness for her grandpa. Mm. We tend to use it as a technique of denial because pain makes us uncomfortable and we like to throw it out. So I can honestly say, I think the best I know, I don't hold anything against Paul. I wish we had the friendship we had when we were writing the book. I would love to have that connection again. I would love to have the honesty in that. I have forgiven him as best I know. Would I write another book with him tomorrow? I would not, because the consequence is you can't be trusted. You know, women battered women back in my day, early in ministry in the 70s, 80s, they were encouraged to forgive their husbands and go back and just keep getting the crud beat out of you. And so forgiveness is a weird word that we use as a matter of convenience oftentimes, not always the way God wanted to use it. And with trauma people especially, the word forgiveness is often thrown in as everybody's uncomfortable. You're talking about some horrible thing your dad did to you, it doesn't have to be sexual. It could be just abandonment or physical abuse or whatever. We just say forgive him and go on. That forgive and go on is not a biblical answer.
Yeah.
Because it takes healing in the heart for where we've been hurt and abused. And even if you forgive the perpetrator, that doesn't negate the healing, the process for healing, what God does to bring light into dark places. So I believe in forgiveness. I think at the end of the day, forgiveness, it was Anne Lamott who said, unforgiveness is like eating rat poison, waiting for the rat to die. We forgive because of the that releases us from the hold of someone else's evil or someone else's darkness. It's not an excuse for them to get away with what they've done. That's not what it is. Mm. So if you can forgive, but still maintain, there are consequences here. There are levels of trust that would have to be rebuilt if we're going back that way.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
And my wife, to move out on me like that, completely unaware, you'd think, well, she's going to have to work to build trust again. She hasn't had to. I trusted her the moment she came back in. I just said, listen, that wasn't you. That was trauma at work in you. That's not the Sarah I know. She would never do that kind of thing. And she even says now, I'm so embarrassed by that. And I'm going, yeah, but you were just trying to survive. That's all trauma people are trying to do. They're just trying to survive. And when you're trying to survive, you can make some very bad choices and still be loved in those bad choices. And so I've never not forgiven her. I hold her really close to my heart. I can't think of anybody right now that I hold enmity against. There are people that hold enmity against me, and I can't do anything about that. But I don't hold it in my heart because it's only going to hurt me. My enmity for other people doesn't hurt them.
Yeah.
It destroys me.
Yeah. Someone said, was it, forgiveness doesn't make you right, it makes you free.
Yeah. And doesn't excuse them. And that's why people struggle to forgive. I gotta forgive. Look what he did. What he did's between God and he or her. You can find in your heart the grace to go on without their ownership of your soul anymore. And that's, I think, what's important to God.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, yeah, again, thank you for your honesty.
You're welcome.
Now, it was interesting because when you and I were talking via email, I picked up that you grew up in a vineyard. So immediately I thought, aha, therefore you know how to make wine. And I then ranted on to you about this particular book that I read about what a vineyard was like. And then you came back with saying, I think you've got the wrong end of the stick here, Martin. We were teetotal family. And I thought, yes, I know that, but it's great. They must be making grapes, you know, to sell. Because, you know, if we go back to Prohibition era, I believe in California, there was one vineyard that was owned by Catholics, and they got around the law to say, well, we need to make communion wine. So that's so they able to keep the vineyard going. And I thought that could have been you. I was wrong. You grew raisins, or you grew grapes to make raisins.
I did grow grapes and dried them on the ground into raisins and sold them, yeah.
Yeah. So what was that lifestyle like that when you were growing up?
It's a lot of work as a kid. That's why my brothers and I all went to college and got degrees and got off the farm. Nobody. It's hard, dusty, hot work in Central California. And the school year is always positioned around the need for the farmers to have their kids at home during certain seasons. So. Ah. Yeah, when everybody else is on school break, you're working your tail off on the vineyard. So I love school, man. I couldn't wait to go back to school.
Brilliant. Well,
after every vacation.
I mean, I tell you what, all the emails that I've had from you, they've got absolute gold nuggets. I'm thinking, right, I need
We've
to ask.
We've had three emails. That's about it.
Yeah, but that's more than one. That's more than one.
All the emails we've spent years communicating.
Oh, yes. We go back, you know, when I was just a little raisin.
Yeah.
Here's the quote. I tend to think the institutional church of today is the one off-grid from what Jesus offered us. The church he is building in the world is very different from the ones we humans build, though that doesn't mean they don't frequently overlap by his incredible mercy. I've read that four or five times today to really understand it, and I'm hoping you could develop a bit more because it's a very powerful statement. So tell me more, please.
Oh, I think I hear that all the time. You know, when people get disillusioned with what we call church and they say they left the church or they did that, or the church hurt me. I got a friend who's passed away from Australia about 30 years ago. He said, let's you and I make a deal. I said, what's that? Let's only use the term church the way God uses the term church. I go, well, that's going to be hard. Because when Jesus speaks of his church as his bride, that's a very endearing conversation. The church without spot or wrinkle. And then we look at what man and what humans have done to co-opt the term church and put it on human institutions and denominations, and that's the church. And so now our language is very, very confused. So when people say, oh, you're kind of out of the church Christian, I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. I've never been out of the church. Man, I've been part of Jesus' church since I was a young kid. I've been in institutional forms of it, and some of those are problematic. I've been in more relational forms of it that are beautiful and wonderful. And some of those relational forms end up institutionalizing themselves into destruction themselves. I think there's a problem, an inherent problem between what an institution needs to survive and what the church needs to thrive. Institutions need conformity. We need doctrine and ritual and practice and authority and control. Those accountability. Those are institution words. Jesus' community needs love and kindness and forgiveness and freedom to grow, to make mistakes, to learn, to not be focused on an individual leader, but learn to follow Jesus himself. So the church Jesus is building in the world, and I've seen it all over, I've traveled all over the world. I've seen it in Asia and Europe and Africa. The church Jesus is building of people who are wanting to know him and be like him and live in his reality in the world, she is beautiful, and she can take on a lot of different forms. The institutional church that we have, almost everyone I've ever been to, there's a network of people inside that institution that are alive in Christ, that are learning the same things, following the same realities. But almost in spite of what the institution is doing, what the institution needs, almost every group that began in a wonderfully organic friendships together with God, caring, sharing, loving, living, and then they become institutions where there's authority and control and conformity. And that's a huge trade-off, and we miss that. So I like that you call your podcast Off-Grid Christianity, because that's fine. I think Christianity is off-grid all over the place. But the Church of Jesus Christ in the world, she's a beautiful bride that he's preparing for his son. But you've got to take your eyes off what man is putting the term to. And that's what confuses people, I think. Like if you've got somebody who's never been to medical school but decides they're a doctor and puts it on a diploma and sets up shop and people come to get doctored. Doesn't matter that he calls himself a doctor. If he's not a doctor, he's not a doctor. Mm. And if the church is not a place where grace is celebrated and faults are looked over and people are loved and control is not exercised by leadership, but facilitating growth in people's lives to follow Jesus and not supplanting it, now you've found expressions of church. I wrote a book about that called Finding Church. And to me, the biggest distinction is right here. What do I do out of endearment to God? Mm-hmm. And what do I do out of obligation? Jesus didn't come to give us obligation. That was the old covenant. He came to give us an endearment with his Father that would cause us to live differently in the world and cause us to celebrate relationships with each other very differently. We do that differently out of endearment than out of the obligation or commitment that says I've got to be in a certain place at a certain time and achieve a certain ethic and do a certain thing. And all that is living by expectations, which is ultimately what law was. Even if it's New Testament principles reformatted as law, it's still law.
Yeah. Obviously, America is massive compared to little Great Britain and Ireland over here and Northern Ireland as well. What's going on in America at the moment have you picked up regarding off-grid Christians going to church. Do you know what? I can't cope with this organized religion anymore. And say going away and doing their own things, maybe on an individual basis. What's going on over there at the moment?
Yeah, the group they've identified now, they call the Duns, those who are outside of religious institutions, but not done with Christ, still passionate followers of Jesus. They didn't leave the institution to deny their faith. They left the institution to preserve their faith. And so there's a lot of people, and COVID only exacerbated that. I mean, I've got lots of email from people that once they stopped attending for a year, and streaming wasn't as interesting as they hoped it would be, and now it's engaging. Because the main reason, I think the best reason to go to a Sunday morning entity is for the relationships that are there. It's not just the show on the stage. It's not the mini concert, mini lecture they throw at us. And so when people stop doing that and start looking more inward, someone said to me recently, and this was somebody wrote me from Europe and said, I began to discover the ugly lies I believe about me and the beautiful truths about God I don't believe yet.
Wow.
And that's been their journey, which I think for many of us who decide, you know what, the institution is a distraction to the journey I want. That's not a condemnation of people who are still there, still find it valuable. It's not. It's just saying it didn't work for me. And now I'm finding God in a real way outside of it and relationships and community that's more vital because it's not routine and obligated and expected. And then people find out more where their hearts really hunger for and the God they're really connect to. And that leads to a better set of questions for me. So I've been outside of it for over 30 years. And I didn't plan to. I got thrown out. I didn't leave. I was going to get back in at some point. But I found too much life out here that I never got back to saying I need to be part of an institution. Other people tell me I need to, but I don't.
Yeah. 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 Yes. I listened to one of your podcasts and I was blown away with a story right at the beginning. And I was hoping you could share now, if that's right, because this story would encompass, I think, what you are saying as well. And it's all about someone who contacted you, came to see you, but went to Starbucks in a little village and walked in and he noticed that in the corner there were some people having a Bible study in Starbucks. Oh. So please tell what happened next.
Yeah, I just met this man too. He'd come out to visit me because he read a book that I had written that had changed his life and he wanted to come out and ask some questions and thought Sarah's story would help him and his wife through some marital things they were dealing with. So we just met him. He said, I got to tell you the story. I got up this morning before we'd met, went to Starbucks and there were people there having a Bible study in the back. And he said, I was listening to him. I was getting my coffee and stuff. And this one guy read a scripture, which he knew could go two ways. It could go into grace and life and following Jesus, or it could go into law and expectation and demand. And surely this old guy took it down the demand road and the expectation road and law road. And so he just went over there and thought he'd say hi. And they were just, hey, come join us. So he said, because kind of like evangelistic or whatever. So he sits down with the group and they go, who are you? And he said, oh, I'm just visiting here from out in Arkansas, he said. And they said, well, what are you doing here? He said, there's an author guy that I read a book, changed my life. So I came out to meet him. So what book was that? So he goes, the book So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. And he said the title of the book. And the guy who just read the passage and was putting the law on these young guys looked up at him and said, you need to take your coffee and tea and you need to go. He goes, what? He said, you need to get out of here. Just the title of the book. Which I've had people buy the book. I had a mother buy it, So You Don't Want to Church Anymore. She bought the book for her son who didn't want to go to church, thinking this would be the 12 reasons why you need to go to church.
Yeah, yeah.
And she assigned it to him as a homeschool assignment, so he had to read it. So he comes out the next day and she says, Mom, did you read this book before you gave it to me? And she said, no, I didn't. He said, I don't think you're going to like this book. And she goes, well, why would you say that? Because I love this book. This guy assumed the title was down the road that would risk whatever he was wanting to do. So he went outside for a while, and just as the guys came out from the Bible study, I get a chance to talk to him in a lot. He asked them, he said, why are you letting that bully run your meetings? I think it's probably ended my time living in this community once it gets around. I live here, and these people now.
Wow.
I think it's beautiful. I think freedom is always challenging to people who labor under legalism. It is. It can't not be. Like what Paul said, that the children of the slave woman will always persecute the children of the free woman. Living free in Christ is a challenging threat to those who find religion rigorous, but important to punch my get out of hell free card. So if you're not here, then you're in danger, because the only reason they're there is because they're afraid of the consequences if they don't. Yeah. And that leads to a very empty spiritual journey. So I always just pray at some point their disillusioning will come to, and they'll be ready to see what else God has for them.
Well, in the remaining few minutes then, for those that have been well and truly challenged by what you've been saying, and just as an aside, I'm going to be interviewing a lady soon who's written a book called Orphaned Believers, which I think is a great title. That comes out next week. Because we're all orphaned, I suppose, for whatever reason. For those that have been challenged today, Wayne, and they think, do you know what? I'm not fed up with God. I'm just fed up with organized religion. I don't feel as if I can go through the church door on a Sunday. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I hurt most for those whose religious experience didn't connect them with the living God. So when they reject the institution, God's in it too. Me, I knew that God was real. And my struggles with some of the institutional elements were that they didn't reflect the nature of the God I knew. So if you have found that your desires in God outstrip your institutional involvement, take a different journey. See where God wants to lead. A lot of people have given up on that to see where else they're going. If you have left that because you've been hurt or shredded, and we've talked about trauma on this podcast, and a trauma is one of those things that the church does not have answers for. The churches we're talking to, I'll put air quotes, okay? Our religious institutions, when they're just about forgiveness and go on, and it just happened in the past, forgetting what's behind, our religion has platitudes. I can say about Christianity, it's a human religion loosely based on the teachings of Jesus. And I will say really loosely based.
Yeah, yeah.
They take some of Jesus' things, they built a religion out of it that has more a business model of trying to keep somebody's salary paid and people in line, and they do it under the guise of we're preparing people for heaven or we're making them more godlike or whatever. When you have a desire in your heart that outstrips your religious involvement, follow the hunger. If you think there must be something more, there really is. And I'd encourage you, even if you've lost sight of God and all that, I'd just start tonight by just saying before you go to bed, Father, if you're real in the way they talked about on this podcast today, would you show me? Would you show me yourself? And let God do it.
Yeah.
You don't need to go find it. Let God do it. Just open the door of your heart to that. And if you have found him to be real, but he's faded away in all your religious obligations, wind up some of those obligations. Get back to a place of endearment. Where's Jesus revealing himself to me, and where is he asking me to live, and what's he nudging in my heart? Because there's a really different way to live this, not out of the intellect of conformity, but out of a heart of passion and endearment to Jesus, who loves us so deeply. Every one of us.
Wow. Sharp intake of breath. I've got to listen to this again to everything you said. Where's Wayne, thank you so much. That is amazing what you shared. Where is Wayne going to be going, do you think, over the next couple of years?
I don't know. Since last April, we're living one day at a time, literally. There's some books I want to write. There's some things I want to do. But the most important thing right now is whatever Sarah needs me to be, to live wholeheartedly now in God's freedom through her trauma, we're going to do. So I don't need to do anything in the world. I don't, you know, we're set in terms of financial whatever. So I have no obligations to anything. I hope to write. We'll keep podcasting because I think we're at a time where if this is not the end of the age, this is certainly the birth pangs of the end of the age. And those people that God talked about in Revelation are willing to follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Mm-hmm. There's a generation of young men and women that need to be equipped to not just be good Christians, but to follow the Lamb wherever he wants to lead them, and have the faith that would get you through coming home and finding your wife gone, or get you through some of the traumatic things in your life. And so I'm going to help encourage people on that road, but I don't know how. Well, it will unfold.
But you just nailed it for me there by saying you're just going to take time out and be with Sarah, because too often we hear, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do this. I remember Billy Graham being interviewed once, I think by Oprah Winfrey, and he said that one of the biggest regrets he ever had was, you know, if he had his time over again, he wouldn't have gone over to whichever country, you know, for 3 or 6 months and come back, and his children would say, "Who are you?" You know, and you know, he was asked by Oprah and said, "You know, did your wife ever think of divorcing you? And he said, divorce, no, murder, yes. Which I thought was quite a funny line as well. But it's true.
It's a funny line.
He would, you know, he would put himself back again and say, whoa, just take time out. And I think it wouldn't be unfair for me to say that if you are going through it at the moment, then maybe one of the best things to do, you know, is to take time out. Would that be fair?
Yeah. I know, I'm convinced that the reason I was put on this planet was to help answer the prayer of a 7-year-old girl who called out from her bed for Jesus to rescue her from what her grandpa was doing to her. And I felt like God told me at one point, I gave you to Sarah, not Sarah to you, I gave you to Sarah because I knew you would help me answer that prayer in her heart. And to be able to hold her through the pain of this, to be rejected like I was and not hold it against her, to keep loving her, to find my way back to her heart, to now be the person in her life that's going to make sure she gets to live wholeheartedly everything God has for her in the last, and we may have 20 years more of life, maybe more, Jesus tarries. And yeah, I am in her life to see her become all that Jesus wants her to become. And if I've got other time to write around that, I probably will. But if I don't, I put the best things I know in the world already. I already have.
Wow, that's amazing. I said right at the very beginning, you know, we often go off on a different tangent. I didn't think we'd go off on a different tangent within one of the five questions. Wayne Jacobson, listen, thanks so much. All that remains for me to say now is, in closing, who is your Christian hero? And when I say by Christian hero, it's somebody who isn't in the Bible and has definitely died. So that we can't then go, oh, yeah, do you know what? You've heard the stories about him or her subsequently. So for someone that's been alive since 2014, and people have to listen to that to understand why. Who's your Christian hero, sir?
I might be my own hero now if I died in 2014. I could go that way. Now, I would go back to Dave Coleman. This man who helped me write the one book and was a close friend of mine. I watched him live a life of immense wisdom and surrender to God and never received any external rewards for it in a way that you could say, wow, that was a ministry that flourished. But here's the wisest man I knew who was living in a home in a neighborhood. And most people who even live in the, and who knew him would never go over and spend time with him. My goodness, I would spend time every time I drove through town. He's my hero of faith because he paid an incredible price to walk in his conscience and never demonstrated any bitterness or hostility. He just continued to lean into what love was. I wish he'd been alive when I'd gotten home and my wife wasn't here. He would have been one of the first phone calls I would have made to say, hey, this has happened to me. So he's definitely my hero in the faith by far.
And the fact that you didn't phone him up and you've got through it, I wonder what he would have said to you. Had you phoned him up?
I don't know. I have no idea. I was left with the Holy Spirit and some other friends who said, I got some incredible advice. I got some great encouragement from Jesus. If you got time for one more story, the first morning I got up after Sarah had left me, I'd spent all night crying. I got nothing sorted. I get up, I go in the bathroom to shave that morning, and I look out the window, and a dove comes and lands on the railing right outside my bathroom window. And I looked at that dove, and it was alone, which doves are not alone. They travel in pairs. They mate for life. Okay. There's lots of imagery there. So it's alone. And I looked at it and said, man, I know how you feel. And just then his partner came and landed next to him. And they cuddled and cooed and flew off. And I just, as clear as I hear God in my heart, he just spoke to my heart and said, this isn't what it appears to be. I will bring her back to you. I saw those doves every day until Sarah was back in my home. I just saw them on our property where we live. One time I was talking to Sarah and she was over and we were just beginning to recommunicate. And I said, is there any chance you want to get back together? And she said, I hope we can, but I can't make any promises. And just then those two doves came and landed on her shoulder. Now, they weren't on her shoulder. They were 20 yards behind her on a limb in a tree. But from my vantage point, it looked like they'd landed right there. And God just kept saying, don't take your encouragement from her. Take it from me. And that was hard to do, I'll be honest with you. There were most days I couldn't hold on to that. I just thought, am I just tricking myself with these stupid birds? So it wasn't as wonderful as it sounds now. There were pain, but every time I come back to, okay, if that's true, then how would I treat Sarah? Knowing that God's going to bring her back, I'd treat her differently than all my fears about having to get her back or having to fix this or having to whatever. So those two doves changed my life. They did, because it turned out to be true.
Wow.
It wasn't what it appeared to be, and God brought her back.
Wow.
Wayne, I couldn't be happier.
On behalf of all the listeners, would you please give her a big hug from us? And would you please,
I will.
And from all us listeners, would you also give yourself a big manly hug from us as well? Or a manly handshake, you know, as we are over here.
I'll let her hug me for you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's even better wording because, you know, what you both have been through, you know, is incredible. I've had an amazing time listening to you. I need to listen to it back straight away so I can get more of what you were saying. Wayne Jacobson.
I've loved it, Martin. Thank you.
Cheers. God bless. Bye-bye.